Right now in Australia overnight, I'm joined by a man who is an international speaker. He is a former cameraman for some of the world's largest networks, and he is a man who dodged bullets, both actual and metaphorical. He joins me now because recently it was the anniversary of the capture of Saddam Hussein after the US-led invasion there. He was one of the men holding the camera. It was an anniversary recently, and we thought, why not get him onto the program to talk about that remarkable historical experience? His name is Greg Morgan, and he joins me now. Good morning, Greg.
Good morning, Tony. Pleasure to be with you.
Well, you've kind of done it all as far as being Johnny on the spot goes. You've been a foreign correspondent for NBC, CNN, BBC, to name but a few. I'd like to talk about your career in a moment, but if we could just start with that particular moment with Saddam Hussein in his spider hole. Talk us through it.
Yes, that was an interesting day and night in Baghdad, Iraq. Is one night and one day I'll never, ever forget. I'd been in Iraq. We were stationed at the Palestine Hotel there in what we called the Green Zone, which was surrounded by 20, 30-foot concrete walls. That said, that wasn't even safe. We were bombed and shot at most nights. Gun battles outside my hotel room every single night, and a few RPGs hit the wall and killed a couple of my colleagues at that time. However, the coalition sent, I was working for APTN at the time in Baghdad, covering the war there for them. And at the time, we were the pool crew, if you like, for the networks around the world. And we would be embedded with US, with the coalition forces. We got tipped off. The coalition forces sort of said, look, we've got a very strong hunch that we're about to capture Saddam Hussein. Get ready. So the media were abuzz with that. We got up and out and out into the streets of Baghdad. And the next thing we know, they're dragging Saddam Hussein out of the hole, which was the footage that I broadcast to the world.
Now, he was hiding in his old tribal area, wasn't he?
Correct. He was indeed. I don't like to call anybody a coward, but he was hiding and he didn't give up a fight. He didn't put up a fight whatsoever.
Yep.
He just surrendered very meekly and mildly, which was baffling to a lot of the coalition forces that thought that he even had a pistol on him. He didn't even put himself away, so to speak. So
yeah.
It's hard to put yourself in that situation, of course, but when you're there and when you're part of it and you feel it and breathe it and you live it and you see the pain and anguish of everyone involved, it was very, very difficult to understand. And so we were going live around the world, and I did a live cross into the Australian networks literally hours later explaining what happened. And I was on the roof of the Palestine Hotel doing a live cross, and I had to wear my flak jacket and my my helmet because the Iraqis were in such jubilation. They were shooting their rifles and guns into the air. And when you shoot into the air, a bullet's going to come down and you don't know where it's going to land. So it can come down with great velocity. But, it was an interesting time, a frightening time, a terrible time. And you know what, Tony, it just hasn't got any better since.
No, it appears not to. You know, with the rise of ISIS and subsequent, instability, some might question the merit or the wisdom of trying to impose democracy on that particular part of the world. So just talk us through then your life or what was life for you then. A phone call would come through and you've got a job, which is always exciting, I guess, if you work freelance or if you're, in any kind of line of work. But yours just happened to be in some of the most unstable regions in the world. What is that like to go to work to?
Oh, yeah, that's a good question. And look, I think the reason why I did it is because, I've been fortunate or unfortunate to be find myself firsthand in situation environments and to witness how people are displaced, whether it's through war zones or tsunamis or natural disasters. It's having that front door to that world of homelessness, if you like, is quite extraordinary. And as a foreign correspondent, I've just been I enjoy filing stories, I suppose, from the most improbable places in the most bewildering circumstances, from, you know, working, as you said earlier, from global broadcasters, the CNN, the BBC. And I would get a phone call, say, from CNN or the BBC or APT in London, and I was based in Southeast Asia for, you know, over a decade, and they would be looking for television personnel to go into these hot spots to start producing content and video content for world audiences. And what got me into that initially was I read a book, One Crowded Hour.
Oh, yes.
One Crowded Hour. Yep. By and you're familiar with that book,
of course.
Yeah. I read that as a young lad, and that just piqued my interest.
That was by an Australian cameraman, wasn't it, who ended up dying in a Thai coup, am I right?
Correct.
Yes.
Exactly. Bangkok, he died. Neil Davis, he died in a coup, filmed his own death. When he was shot, he fell down. The camera fell down and was still rolling. And he filmed his own death. I remember reading that, as I said earlier, as a young lad. And it just piqued my interest. I thought, I wonder what it's really like in those situations. And I've been fascinated by war ever since. And then I remember being based in Malaysia and NBC America, where I was watching the Twin Towers being shot down by the planes in 2011. I just had this gut feeling that was Osama bin Laden. And NBC called me literally 5 hours later and said, can you get into Kabul, into Afghanistan, because we're on the hunt. The Americans are on the hunt for Osama bin Laden. They think he's done this. So that was my first entree into war. And I've always wanted to do it and feel it and cover in the footsteps of the great Neil Davis, an Australian cameraman. And I did that, yeah.
Why was your hunch about Osama bin Laden in that particular case? What was that based on?
That was based on, I've done a lot of reading on the Middle East war and also Osama bin Laden. And I've done a few interviews with professors about the Middle East and for NBC and CNN before. And I just put bits together, and I just had this hunch. It'd have to be Osama bin Laden. I don't know why I thought that. I just did. And the hunch was right. And I was looking forward to going in there. But at the same time, it was probably one of the most frightening things I've ever done in my life.
Yeah. So in those kind of places that you've gone, which are highly unstable, anything's likely to happen, how is the fact that you're an Australian usually greeted?
Well, when you're in an international environment like that, you're working with a lot of foreigners, such as Americans, British, Europeans, even locals, whether they're Afghanis or in Iraq war, Iraqis, and we all treat each other with the utmost respect. We respect each other's cultures, and we just get on with the job at hand. So that's a good thing. But however, when you the Afghan war changed the landscape a little bit, because you look back at World War One, World War Two, but these wars is when the media became a target, if you like.
Yeah.
And I was there in Afghanistan, and when Osama bin Laden put a bounty on the heads of all media people, and I was there when five or six journalists and camera crews, even the ABC guy from Sydney, were bound up by the Taliban, tortured and shot dead. So I was in a car not far behind them. And so it just changed the landscape. It was very, very dangerous. Now, even in the Iraq war, I mean, it's set up in the Palestine Hotel, and militants would pull up outside the hotel and just throw and let go an RPG into the wall of our hotel, and we'd be scrambling along the corridors of the hotel trying to find cover as, you know, the barrage of bullets were hitting the wall. It's quite extraordinary, but the adrenaline, it's hard to explain the adrenaline, goes through you at the time. But to witness these places and people change with the people who share your passion of telling the truth and storytelling is the most humbling of experiences.
How do you adjust to life not doing that? I mean, you're on the speaking circuit now. You're an international speaker, and you can be found through smntalkingtalent.com.au. But how do you adjust to, let's say, the more mundane life, Greg?
Yeah, look, there's always that question about post-traumatic stress syndrome. And look, there's no doubt I suffered from that. I found it very difficult to move back into everyday life after that. And I'm not a soldier, so I can only imagine what it's like for soldiers. I wasn't out there shooting people and protecting myself and killing people, but I did see a lot of death while I was there. I saw a lot of people shot. Colleagues, as I said earlier, friends of mine that were killed just doing their job. It's very difficult, but you call upon your family and friends, your close network of people, and try and find a job. And I was lucky enough to start my own business after I finished that in the digital world, and still did some TV work, and then became a CEO of a couple of companies. I think that with my war experiences helped me become a better leader in the corporate world, so to speak. So, but it was very tough, and for a number of years after that, I would hear a car backfire and I would shudder. And yeah, definitely, without a doubt. Yeah, I did have to have some medical help.
Yeah, well, there's no disgrace in that. That's for sure. Now, in your bio, you mentioned having worked with Jackie Chan and Bush. I would imagine that's George W. The Clintons, Dalai Lama, Princess Di. Have you got one particular story about any of those that you think would interest those of us here at Australia Overnight?
You know what? I've got stories about all of them, and the old saying, "What stays in Vegas, stays in Vegas." But I'll tell you one story.
Please.
I didn't expect this question. I'll tell you one story about Jackie Chan.
Yeah,
I was the director of photography on a Jackie Chan film in New Territories out of Hong Kong in China there, and I was the only Westerner on the set apart from the guy who wrote the film. And the Jackie Chan group, and I was based in Hong Kong for 4 or 5 years, and the Jackie Chan group decided to take me on as the DOP as opposed to their normal DOP. They wanted a Western influence to give a different slant to the film, different look to the film, so to speak. And so we had a Cantonese director, and he was calling all the shots in Cantonese, and I didn't understand Cantonese. And even though I worked in Hong Kong for 4 or 5 years, I understood a bit of Cantonese, but not a lot. So, and then we'd just have to stop the shoot, and I'd have to turn around and say, "Look, could you just talk to me, give me the directions, what you're looking for in English?" And Jackie would come on set one morning and then sit around, and he wouldn't even get up, and he decided not to, like, take part in the film. And I would talk to him. I said, "Jackie, I've been here since 5 o'clock this morning. We've set up everything, got a crew of 50 I'm taken care of. Why don't you do this?" "No, I'm not in the mood." So he'd just go home and off he'd go. And that was the end of the shoot for the day. And then he'd come back the next day and he'd come and sit down. And I was the only Westerner on the set, as I said. And he'd come and sit down next to me and said, "Well, what are you doing?" "I'm just flicking through a magazine." I said, "Well, I've been waiting for you to arrive on set." He said, "Yeah, okay, I feel like doing it today." So we'd shoot for 12 or 13 hours. Then I was walking outside of the studios, and I heard trying to get a train back to my house in Happy Valley in Hong Kong, and heard the toot in the car, and I turned around, and it was Jackie, and he wound down the window, and he said, "Do you want a lift?" I said, "Yeah, sure." So he gave me a lift back home. We were having a good chat, and I asked him about why he didn't want to do it, and he said, "Look, the studio's got one over me, and they're not paying me much money. I'm not interested, but it's part of my contract," and so on. So interesting enough, though, Tony, I'll go back to the set the next day, and the Cantonese people who were being a bit difficult towards me being a Westerner, they changed their tune, changed their tact, and they were all talking in English, and I was very, very amenable because they saw Jackie drive me home. It just changed the whole culture of the set. It was terrific. So, Jackie and I have been friends ever since. So, yeah, very good.
There you go. It's it's not what you know. It's who you know. It's also the threat of physical violence from a master in martial arts, that if you're not nice to one of his mates. So I guess that helps
there
too.
There you go. Yeah,
all right.
Very much so. Very much so.
Thank you so much for that, Greg Morgan, for sharing some of the highlights of your long and distinguished career, dangerous career. You've also survived bowel cancer, which is a chat for another time. But I said, you can contact Greg and certainly with a view to listening to some of his stories through smntalkingtalent.com.au. Pleasure, Greg. Thank you for your time.
Pleasure. Thank you very much. All the best.